Mace was Practice's preferred method of attack, for he wore heavy metal gauntlets powerfully enchanted for battle. The dwarf continued to bore in, pressing his face into the gargoyle's chest. He let go of his mace and began driving his fists one after another into the gargoyle's midsection, each heavy blow bringing forth a gasping growl and lifting the gargoyle from the ground. Beside him, Arayan reoriented herself to the battle. A heavy thump brought her attention to Olgercon, his club sending the blind gargoyle into a sidelong spin, so brutal was the blow. Arayan caught movement out of the corner of her eye and grabbed at her pouch where she kept her spellcasting ingredients. She waved her hand and called forth her magic, and the air above and to the side of Olgercon filled with stringy, web-like strands. Arayan had nothing upon which to set her web, so it didn't stop the descent of the gargoyle. But by the time the creature hit the ground between her and Olgercon, it was all tangled and fighting furiously to pull free of the sticky filaments. Its predicament only worsened when a second gargoyle flew past Arayan, tumbling down at the entangled one's feet and tripping it up. Right behind that battered form came Practice, howling his battle cry. And Olgercon was there too, driving his club down with heavy chops that shattered gargoyle bone. Those chops quickly diminished, though, and Practice turned to question the large half-orc. The words stuck in the dwarf's mouth, however, when he realized that Olgercon was gasping for breath, exhausted and struggling. The dwarf eyed him with curiosity, not quite understanding. The warrior had suffered no serious hits, and the fight had hardly begun. Shaking his head, Practice could only turn and look for something else to hit. And Treri wondered why he even bothered to stand up again after yet another roll beneath the reaching claws of a diving gargoyle. He also wondered why in the Nine Hells the warrior dwarf and the thin wizard hadn't yet joined the fray. He figured that would soon enough be remedied in any case, as a gargoyle swept down into the wizard's small tent, tearing through the fabric with abandon. But the two were not in there. And Treri's eyes narrowed as the tent fell away, leaving the gargoyle standing confused before a rope hanging in midair. The gargoyle tugged, then climbed. Its head and shoulders disappeared into an extra-dimensional pocket. There was a brilliant flash of flame, and the decapitated body of the gargoyle tumbled to the ground. Out of thin air leaped Athrogate, one of his morning stars smoking.
"Give me the boys, and yourself fights the girls," he roared. "For everyone knows there's claws in them curls. Bwahaha!"
And Treri prayed that a dozen gargoyles would throttle the little beast. A pair seemed as if they would do exactly that, soaring down fast, but the dwarf's spinning morning stars kept them at bay, and a searing bolt of lightning flashed out from the extra-dimensional pocket. From across the way, and Treri marked that lightning blast clearly, for so intense was the power that the gargoyles were incinerated and thrown away. He saw Campin's face peeking out above the rope, and he knew then that the frail-looking wizard was not one to be taken lightly. A third gargoyle on the ground charged at the dwarf, who howled and charged right back. The creature came in and snapped its head forward to gore with its horn, but Athrogate leaped and similarly head-butted, forcing an impact with the creature's forehead before it could bring the horn in line. Dwarf and gargoyle bounced back, both standing staring at each other and seeming as if on shaky legs. Athrogate yelled, "Bwahaha!" again, snorted and launched a wad of spit into the gargoyle's face.
"Mark you with spit, so I know where to hit," he cried.
The dwarf went into a sudden spin, coming around with a leading morning star that crunched against the stunned gargoyle's face. The creature's head snapped back. Its arms out wide, the gargoyle arched its back and stared up at the dark sky. Athrogate twisted his torso as he continued his spin so that his arms were on the diagonal, and his second morning star's spiked head came in on the gargoyle descending from on high. The creature jolted down and seemed to bounce, and it appeared as if it would just fall over. The dwarf was taking no chances, though, or was just enjoying it all too much. He put the weapons in tighter, alternating spins above his head, slamming the gargoyle several times, driving it back, back, until he finally just let the dead thing fall to the ground.
"Bwa-ha-ha!" the dwarf yelled as he charged in the direction of Pratkis and the two half-orcs. He cut back suddenly, though, his heavy boots digging ruts in the ground. And Treri shook his head and started the same way, but he pulled up as the dwarf halted and turned around. He knew what had gotten Athrogate's attention, and a lump appeared in his throat as he watched a quartet of gargoyles diving at the drow's globe of darkness. "Jarlaxle!" he cried. The assassin winced as the gargoyles disappeared into the impenetrable shadow. Howls and screams, shrieks of pain and bloodthirsty hunger erupted from within, and Treri found it hard to breathe. "Get there, dwarf," he heard himself whispering.
Chapter 13 The Living Castle. Pratkis could tell that the half-orcs beside him were faltering, and he frantically cheered them on with both words and prayers. He called upon his god to bless his allies and sent waves of healing magic into them, sealing their wounds. But still they floundered. Arayan threw out bursts of destructive magical energy, but her repertoire fast diminished, and many of her magical attacks were no more than cantrips, minor spells that inconvenienced an enemy more than they truly hurt it. No one could question the determination and bravery of Olgercon, standing strong as a rock against the current of the Gargoyle River, at least at first. Eventually, the large half-orc seemed more a mound of sand, cracking and weakening, his very solidity seeming to lessen. Something was wrong, Pratkis knew. Either the pair was not nearly as formidable as they had initially seemed, or their strength was draining far too quickly. The gargoyles seemed to sense it, too. They came on more furiously and more directly, and Pratkis fell back as one crossed over Olgercon, the half-orc's sluggish swing not coming close to intercepting it, and dived at the cleric. Pratkis threw his hands up defensively, expecting to be overwhelmed, but he noticed the gargoyle jerk awkwardly, then again. As the dwarf dodged aside, the creature didn't react, but just kept its current course, slamming face first into the ground. Pratkis's eyes widened as he noted two feathered arrows protruding from the dead gargoyle's side. The dwarf scrambled to the northern lip of the hillock and saw his two missing companions battling furiously. Ellery guarded Mariabrone's flank, her mighty axe cutting great sweeps through the air, taking the reaching limbs from any gargoyles who ventured too near. With the warrior woman protecting him, Mariabrone, the legendary rover of Vasa, put his great bow to deadly use, sending lines of arrows soaring into the night sky, almost every one finding its mark in the hide of a hovering gargoyle. "I need ye!" Pratkis yelled down, and the two heroes heeded the call and immediately charged the dwarf's way. Even that movement was perfectly coordinated, with Ellery circling around Mariabrone, protecting his rear and both flanks, while the ranger's bow twanged in rapid order, clearing any enemies from before them. They joined Pratkis not a moment too soon, for Olgercon was near to collapse. The half-orc, down on one knee, barely managed to defend himself against a gargoyle that would have soon killed him, had not Mariabrone's arrow taken the thing in the throat. Beside the large half-orc, Arayan, her spells depleted, stood with dagger in hand. She slashed wildly, her every movement off-balanced and exaggerated, her every cut leaving openings in her defenses that any novice warrior could easily exploit. Ellery leaped to Arayan's side as the gargoyle bore down on the half-orc woman, its arms out wide to wrap her in its deadly embrace. That momentum halted when an overhand chop put the warrior woman's axe head deep into the gargoyle's chest. Arayan fell back with a squeal, tripping to the ground. Ellery noted a second creature's approach and tried desperately to tear her axe free, but it got hooked on one of the dead creature's ribs. Ellery reached across with her shield to fend it off, but knew she was vulnerable. The gargoyle's shriek was not one of hungry victory, however, but of pain and surprise, as a pair of arrows knifed into its chest. Ellery managed to glance back and offer an appreciative nod to Mariabrone. The ranger didn't notice, for he was already sighting his next target, bow drawn and arrow ready to fly. Beside him, Pratkis breathed a sigh of relief. Athrogate could not get to the globe in time, and Entreri watched helplessly as the four gargoyles disappeared into the darkness. Howls and shrieks erupted immediately, a flurry of claws slapping at flesh, and a cacophony of opposing screeches blending and melding into a macabre song of death. "Jarlaxle," Entreri whispered, and he knew again that he was alone. "They do make a mess of it," remarked a familiar voice, and Entreri nearly jumped out of his boots when he noted the dark elf standing next to him. Jarlaxle held a thin metallic wand tipped with a ruby. He reached out and spoke a command word, and a tiny pill of fire arched out at the globe of darkness. Noting the angle of the fiery pea and the approach of Athrogate, it seemed to Entreri almost as if the drow was tossing it to the roaring dwarf. Entreri thought to yell out a warning to Athrogate, but he knew that his call could do nothing to deter the committed warrior. The pea disappeared into the darkness. So did the dwarf. A burst of flame lit the night, erupting from the globe, and when it was done, the darkness was gone and six gargoyles lay smoldering on the ground. Athrogate ran out the other side, trailing wisps of smoke and a stream of colorful curses. "Tough little fellow," Jarlaxle remarked.
"More's the pity," said Entreri.
Across the way, Canthan poked his head out of his extra-dimensional pocket and watched the goings-on with great amusement. He saw Ellery and Mariabrone charge to the aid of the dwarf cleric and the two half-orcs, and was distracted by the roar of Athrogate. That one was always roaring, as the dwarf bounded toward a globe of darkness. It was a drow's globe, Canthan knew, and if the dark elf was inside it, the wizard could only hope the gargoyles would make fast work of him. A familiar sight, usually one leaving his own hands, crossed into his field of vision right to left, and he backtracked it quickly to see the dark elf standing beside Entreri, wand in hand. A glance back made Canthan wince for his gruff ally, but it was one of instinct and reaction, certainly not of sympathy for the dwarf. Athrogate came through the fireball, of course, smoking and cursing. Canthan hardly paid him any heed, for his gaze went back to Jarlaxle. Who was this drow elf? And who was that deadly sidekick of his, standing amidst the inedible carrion of dead gargoyles? The wizard didn't lie to himself and insist that he wasn't impressed. Canthan had served Nellict for many years, and in the hierarchy of the Citadel of Assassins, survival meant never underestimating either your friends or your foes.
"Why are you here, drow?" Canthan whispered into the night air.
At that moment, Jarlaxle happened to turn his way and obviously spotted him, for the drow gave a tip of his great plumed hat. Canthan chewed his lip and silently cursed himself for the error. He should have cast an enchantment of invisibility before poking his head out. But the drow would have seen him anyway, he suspected. He gave a helpless sigh and grabbed the rope, rolling out so that he landed on his feet. A glance around told him that the fight was over, the gargoyles destroyed, and so with a snap of his fingers he dismissed his extra-dimensional pocket.
"The castle is alive," Olger Khan said.
He was bent over at the waist, huffing and puffing, and it seemed to the others that it was all he could do to hold his footing and not sink down to his knees. At his side, Arayan put a hand on his shoulder, though she seemed equally drained.
"And already more gargoyles are growing," said old Wingham, coming up the northern side of the hill. "On the battlements, I mean. Even as that force flew off into the night, more began to take shape in their vacated places."
"Well now, there is a lovely twist," Canthan remarked.
"We must tear down the castle," declared Pratgis. "By the will of Moradin, no such an abomination as that will stand. Though I'm guessing that Dumathoin would be wanting to find out how the magic of the place is doing such a thing."
"A high wall of iron and stone," Mariabrone said.
"Tear it down? Has Palaszczuk the capability to begin such a venture as that?"
From his tone, it was clear that the ranger's question was a rhetorical one.
We are fortunate that this group flew our way, said Wingham. What havoc might they have wrought upon the unsuspecting folk of Palaszczuk?
Unsuspecting no more, then, the ranger agreed.
We will set the defenses. Or prepare the runnin', put in a snickering Atheragate.
King Gareth will send an army if need be, said Ellery. Pratkus is correct. This abomination will not stand.
Ah, but would we not all be the fools to attack an armored turtle through its shell? Said Jarlaxle, turning all eyes, particularly those of Entreri, his way. Ye got a better idea? Atherogate asked.
I have some experience with these Jingian constructs, the drow admitted. My friend and I defeated a tower not unlike this one, though much smaller, of course, back on the outskirts of Heliogabalus.
Atherogate raised an eyebrow at that.
Ye were part of that. A few days afore we left on the caravan to Bloodstone Pass. That big rumble in the east?
Aye, good dwarf, Jarlaxle replied. 'Twas myself and good Entreri here who laid low the tower and its evil minions.
Bwahaha!
Entreri just shook his head as Jarlaxle dipped a low bow. The way to win, the drow said as he straightened, is from the inside. Crawl in through the hard shell to the soft underbelly.
Soft? Now there's a word,
remarked an obviously flustered and suspicious Entreri, and when Jarlaxle glanced his way, he saw that his friend was none too happy, and none too trusting, his dark eyes throwing darts at the drow.
We're listening, good drow,
Maria Brone prompted.
The castle has a king, a life force holding it together, Jarlaxle explained, though of course he had no idea if he was on target or not.
Certainly the tower back in Heliogabalus had crumbled when the gem had been plucked from the book, and the sisters told him that killing the lich would have served the same purpose. But in truth, he had no more than a guess concerning the much grander structure. And if the structure was so much bigger, then what of its king?
If we destroy this life force, the tower, the castle, will unbind, the drow went on. All that will be left will be a pile of stone and metal for the blacksmiths and stonemasons to forage through.
He noted as he finished that, that both Arrayan and Olgercon shifted uneasily. That told him a lot.
Perhaps it would be better to alert King Gareth,
a doubting Maria Brone replied.
Master Wingham can send runners from Palaszczuk to that end, Commander Ellery declared. For now our course is clear. Through the shell, then, into the soft insides.
So says yourself,
blustered Atherogate.
So I do, good dwarf, said Ellery. I will enter the castle at dawn.
She paused and glanced at each of them in turn.
I brought you out here for just an eventuality such as this. Now the enemy is clear before us. Palaszczuk cannot wait for word to get to Bloodstone Village and for an army to be assembled. And so I go in. I will not command any of you to follow, but—
Of course you will not have to, Jarlaxle interrupted. And when all eyes turned his way again, he dipped another bow.
We ventured forth for just an eventuality such as this, and so by your side we stand.
By his side, Jarlaxle could feel Entreri's gaze boring into him.
Bwahaha!
Atherogate bellowed again.
Yes, of course, we must investigate this further, said Canthan.
By Dumathoin, said Pratkus. All of you, then, Wingham remarked. With Arrayan and Olgercon, you will vanquish this menace. Of that I am sure. Them too,
Atherogate asked with a great harumph.
They represent the finest of Palaszczuk, Wingham replied. Then get the whole damn town running now, and save yourself the trouble.
Easy, good dwarf, said Canthan.
We'll be spending more time dragging them two about than hunting the enemy, Atherogate grumbled. I ain't for—
Enough, good dwarf, said Canthan.
Arrayan moved from Olderkon's side to face the furious dwarf.
"We will not fail in this,"
she said.
"Bah!"
Athrogate snorted, and he turned away. "Two replacements for us," Entreri whispered to Jarl Axel as they moved back across the hilltop to their respective bedrolls. "You would not wish to miss this grand adventure, of course."
"You knew about it all along," the assassin accused. "The sisters sent us up here for precisely this."
"We have already been through this," replied the drow. "A library has been opened, obviously, and so the adventure unwinds."
"The tower we defeated wouldn't serve as a guardhouse for this structure," Entreri warned. "And that lich was beyond us."
"The lich is destroyed."
"So is my glove."
Jarl Axel stopped walking and stared at his friend for a few moments. "A fine point," he conceded finally. "But worry not, for we'll find a way."
"That is the best answer you can find."
"We always do find a way."
"And we always shall, I suppose?"
"Of course."
"Until the last time." "There will be only one last time."
Jarl Axel considered that for a few moments. Then he shrugged.
"First time them two fall down will only be giving me a softer place to put me boot,"
Athrogate grumbled, sitting on the torn fabric that used to be Canthan's tent. He rambled on with his unceasing complaints, but the wizard wasn't listening. Canthan's eyes were focused across the way, where Wingham was sitting with Arrayan and Olderkon. Something wasn't right with those two.
"What? What?"
the dwarf asked him, apparently taking heed of the fact that he wasn't being listened to and not much enjoying it. Canthan began to cast a quick spell, and a translucent shape, somewhat like an ear, appeared floating in midair before him. He puffed on it, and it drifted away, gliding toward the conversation on the northern side of the encampment. The female Arrayan moved off, leaving Wingham alone with the brutish Olderkon. And with Canthan. Though, of course, Wingham didn't know that.
"You know our deal,"
the old half-orc said, his tone grave.
"I know." "It must not get too far gone,"
Wingham said.
"There can be no delay, no staying of your hand if the killing blow is needed." "I know,"
the larger half-orc growled.
"Olderkon, I am as wounded by this possibility as are you,"
Wingham said.
"This is neither my choice nor my desire. We follow the only road possible, or all is already lost."
His voice trailed off. And Olderkon held his response as Arrayan moved back to them.
"Interesting,"
mumbled Canthan.
"What? What?"
bellowed Athrogate.
"Nothing. Perhaps," said the wizard, turning to face his friend.
He glanced back across the way as he added,
"Or perhaps everything."
Face down, his arms bound behind him, his head hooded, Nyungi had all but given up hope. Resigned to his doom, he wasn't even crying out anymore. But then a hand grabbed his hood and gently pulled it back, and the old sage found himself staring into the face of his friend.
"How many days?"
he gasped through his dry, cracked lips.
"Only two,"
Wingham replied.
"I tried to get to you earlier, but Olderkon—"
He finished with a sigh and held up his wrists, cut cords still hanging from them.
"Your young friend has gone mad."
"He protects the girl."
"Your niece."
There was no missing the accusation in that tone. Wingham looked at Nyungi hard, but only for a moment, then moved around and began to untie him.
to simply murder.
It is not murder, as she brought it on herself.
Unwittingly.
Irrelevant. You would see the city endangered for the sake of one girl?
Asked the sage. Again Wingham held up his wrists, but Nyungi was too sly to fall for that ruse.
You play a dangerous game here, Wingham.
Wingham offered a sigh and said,
The game was begun before ever I knew the dangers, and once set in motion there was no other course before us.
You could have killed the girl and been done with it.
Wingham paused for just a moment.
Come, he bade his old friend. We must prepare the city.
Where is the girl?
Heroes have come from the Vossen Gate.
Where is the girl?
She went into the castle.
Youngie's eyes widened, and he seemed as if he might simply fall over.
With Commander Ellery, niece of Gareth Dragonsbane, Wingham explained, and with Maria Brown the Rover.
Youngie continued to stare, then nodded and asked,
Old Jerkon is with her?
With instructions not to allow the structure to take her, at all costs.
The old sage considered it all for some time.
Too dangerous,
he decided with a shake of his head, and he started walking past Wingham.
Where are you going?
Didn't you just say that we had to go and prepare the city? But prepare it for what? To defend? Or to run?
A little of both, I fear, Wingham conceded. Part 3. Secrets Within. Secrets Without.
Many times during his journey back to the apartment he shared with Entreri, Jarlaxle fished the violet glowing gem out of his pocket. Many times he held it up before his eyes, pondering the possibilities hidden inside its skull-like facets as he vividly recalled the sensations at the graveyard. It was a power, necromancy, of which Jarlaxle knew little, and one that piqued his curiosity. What gains might he realize from that purple gem? The book that had hidden it had been destroyed. Gone, too, was the tower it had created from feeding on the life force of Herminical. All that remained was rubble and scraps. But the gem survived, and it thrummed with power. It was the real prize. The book had been the icing, as sweet as anything Piter spread on his creations. But the gem, that violet skull, was the cake itself. If its powers could be harnessed and utilized, to build another tower, perhaps? To find a better connection to the dead, for information? To find allies among the dead? The dark elf could hardly contain his grin. He so loved new magical toys to examine, and his near-disastrous companionship with the infamous artifact Crenshinabon, the Crystal Shard, had done little to dampen his insatiable curiosity. He wished that Camoriel was available to him, for the drow psionicist could unravel the deepest of magical mysteries with ease. If only Jarlaxle had found the skull gem before his last meeting with his lieutenant. But he would have to wait 10 days for their next appointed rendezvous. What can you do for me? He whispered to the skull gem. And perhaps it was his imagination. But the item seemed to flare with eagerness. And that Jengian artifact was of little consequence, comparatively speaking, if the fear in Ilnazara's eyes was any indication. What other treasures lay up there in wait for him and Entreri? What other toys had Jengi left scattered about to bring mischief to his vanquishers? Power to topple a king, perhaps? Or power to create a king? That last thought hung in the air, waiting for the drow to grab it and examine it. He considered the road he and Entreri had traveled to get to Heliogabalus and the still untamed Bloodstone Lands. Wandering adventurers they were, profiteers in heroes' clothing. Living free and running free, turning their backs to the wind, whichever way that wind was blowing.
No purpose led them, save the drow's desire for a new experience, some excitement different from that which had surrounded him for so many centuries. For Entreri, the same? No, Jarlaxle thought. It wasn't the lure of new experiences that guided Entreri, but some other need that the assassin likely didn't even understand himself. Entreri didn't know why he stayed by Jarlaxle's side along their meandering road. But Jarlaxle knew, and he knew too that Entreri would stay with him as that road led them farther to the north to the wilds of Vasa and the promise of greater treasure than even the Skull Gem. How might Entreri react if Jarlaxle decided they should stay for some time, forever perhaps as measured in the life of a human? If Zhengian artifacts fell into their hands, the power to tear down a kingdom or to build one, would Entreri willingly participate? One journey at a time, Jarlaxle decided, even as he came upon the wooden staircase that led to the balcony of their second-story apartment. The sun was up by then, burning through the heavy mist of the eastern sky. Jarlaxle paused there to consider the parting words of the two dragon sisters.
The secrets of Zhengyi were greater than Zhengyi. The folk of Damara, King Gareth most of all, pray that those secrets died with the Witch King,
Ilnazara had said with certainty.
But now we know that they did not, Tazmakella had added. Some of them at least have survived.
Jarlaxle remembered the words, and recalled even more vividly the timbre with which they were spoken, the reverence and even fear. He recalled the look in their respective eyes, sparkling with eagerness, intrigue, and terror. With all due respect, King Gareth, Jarlaxle said to the misty morning air, let us hope that little was destroyed. He glanced down the street, to the little shop where he had set up Piter the Baker. Its doors weren't open yet, but Jarlaxle knew that his portly friend would not refuse him admittance. A short while later, he started up the staircase, knowing that the first battle along his new road, that of convincing the sour, still hurting Entreri, lay behind his multi-trapped door. Chapter 14 Zhengyi's Alternate World. So complete was the castle construction that by the time the nine companions approached the front gates the next morning, they found a fanciful and well-designed flagstone walkway leading to them. On the walls to either side of the closed portcullis, half-formed gargoyles leered at the approaching troop, and in the few moments it took them to reach the portcullis, those statues grew into an even more defined form.
They will be ready to launch into the sky again this night, Maria Brown noted. Wingham would do well to force Palaszczuk into a strong defensive posture.
For all the good that'll do him,
Athrogate grumbled.
Then let us be quick about our task,
Ellery replied.
We heroes,
Entreri muttered under his breath, so that only Jarlaxle, standing right beside him at the back of the line, could hear. The drow was about to respond, but he felt a sudden tug at his sensibilities. Not sure what that might mean, Jarlaxle put a hand over the magical button on his waistcoat, wherein he had stored the skull gem. A look of concern flashed over his angular face. Could it be that the magical gems could call to each other? Had he erred in bringing his skull gem near to the new construct? Maria Brown was first to the portcullis, its iron spikes as thick as his arms. He peered through the bars at the castle's lower bailey.
It appears empty, he reported, as the others came up beside him. I can get a grapnel over the wall, perhaps, and locate the hoist.
No need,
Canthan said, and the thin wizard nodded at Athrogate.
Bah!
The dwarf snorted, and he moved up and gently nudged Maria Brona aside.
Gonna pop out me guts, ye stupid mage!
We all have our uses, Canthan replied to him. Some of us attend to them without so much blather, however.
Some of ye sit back and wiggle your fingers, while some of us stop clubs with our faces.
Good that there's not much beauty to steal, then.
Bah!
The other seven listened with some amusement, but the banter struck Entreri and Jarlaxle more poignantly.
"Those two sound a bit familiar," Entreri lamented.
"Though not as witty, of course. And therein lies the rub," said the drow.
Athrogate spat in his hands and grabbed at the portcullis, knees bent. He grunted and tried to straighten, to no effect, so he gave another roar, spat in his hands again, and reset his grip.
"A little help, if ye might," he said.
Maria Brown grabbed the portcullis on one side of the dwarf, while both Pratkis and Olgercon positioned themselves on the other side.
"Not yourselves, ye bunch of dolts,"
the dwarf grumbled. Behind them, Canthan completed the words of a spell, and a wave of energy rolled out from the wizard's hands to encompass the dwarf. Muscles bulged and bones crackled as they grew, and Athrogate swelled to the size of a large man and continued to grow.
"And again,"
the dwarf demanded, his voice even more resonant. Canthan uttered a second enchantment, and soon Athrogate was the size of an ogre, his already muscular arms as thick as old trees.
"Bah!"
he growled in his booming bass voice, and with a roar of defiance he began to straighten his legs. The portcullis groaned in protest, but the dwarf pressed on, bringing it up from the ground.
"Get ye going!"
he howled, but even as he said it, even as Entreri and Ellery both made to dive under, Athrogate growled and began to bend, and the other three couldn't begin to slow the descent of the huge barrier. Entreri, the quicker by far to the ground, was also the quicker to halt his movement and spin back, and he managed to grab the diving Ellery as he went and deflect her enough so that she did not get pinned under the heavy spiked gate as it crashed back to earth. The commander cried out, as did Arrayan and Pratkis, but Canthan merely chuckled, and Jarlaxle, caught up in the curious sensations of the skull gem, hadn't even heard the call or noticed the lifting of the portcullis, let alone the near loss of one of their companions. When he looked at Athrogate, suddenly so much larger than before, his eyes widened and he fell back several steps.
"Oh, ye son of a bar whore!"
Athrogate cursed. And it did not miss Jarlaxle's notice that Entreri shot the dwarf a quick glance that would have curdled milk. Because of the gate's swift descent, the drow wondered? Or was it those few words? Very rarely did Jarlaxle glimpse into the depths of the puzzle that was Artemis Entreri, for the disciplined assassin rarely wore his emotions in his expression. Every now and then, though, Athrogate stormed about, rubbing his calloused hands together and repeatedly tightening his belt, a great and decorated girdle with a silver buckle set with crossed lightning bolts.
"By the gods, dwarf," Maria Brown said to Athrogate, "I do believe that you were lifting that practically by yourself, and that our helping hands were of little or no consequence. When you bent, I felt as if a mountain was descending upon me."
"Wizard spell!"
Athrogate grumbled, though he hardly sounded convinced.
"Then I pray you cast the enchantment on us others," Maria Brown bade Canthan. "This gate will rise with ease in that case."
"My spells are exhausted," the wizard said, as unconvincingly as the dwarf.
Jarlaxle looked from Canthan to Athrogate, sizing them up. No doubt the spell of enlargement had played some role, but that was not the source of the dwarf's incredible strength. Again Athrogate went to his belt, tightening it yet another notch, and the drow smiled. There were girdles said to imbue their wearer with the strength of a giant, the greatest of which were the storm giants that threw lightning bolts across mountain peaks. Jarlaxle focused on Athrogate's belt buckle, and the lightning bolts it displayed. Athrogate went back to stand in front of the portcullis, hands on hips and staring at it as if it were a betraying wife. Once or twice he started to reach out and touch the thick bars, but always he retracted his hands and grumbled.
"I ain't about to lift it,"
he finally admitted. The dwarf grumbled again and nodded as the first of Canthan's enlargement dwyamers wore off, reducing him to the size of a large man. By the time Athrogate sighed and turned about, he was a dwarf again. Intimidating, to be sure, but still a dwarf.
"Over the wall, then," said Maria Brown. "Nah,"
the dwarf corrected.
He pulled his twin morning stars off of his back and set them to twirling, glass steel gleaming dully in the soft morning light. He brought the handle of the one in his left hand up before his face and whispered something. A reddish-gray liquid began to ooze from the small nubs on the striking ball, coating the whole of the business end of the weapon. Then he brought up the right-hand weapon and similarly whispered, and the liquid oozed forth on that one, too, only the gooey stuff was blue-gray instead of red.
"Get back, ye dolt!" he said when Ellery moved near to investigate. "You're not for wanting to get any of this on that splendid silver armor of yours, ha-ha!"
His laugh became a growl, and he put his morning stars up in whistling spins above his head. Then he turned a complete circuit, gathering momentum, and launched the red-covered weapon head in a mighty swing against one of the portcullis's vertical bars. He followed with a smash from the other weapon, one that created an explosion that shook the ground beneath the feet of all the stunned onlookers. Another spin became a second thunderous retort, the dwarf striking, one, two, and always with a red-colored morning star leading, a perpendicular bar. Another hit took that crossing horizontal bar again. To the amazement of all save Canthan, who stood watching with a sour expression, the thick crossbar broke in half, midway between two vertical spikes. Aphrogate went back to work on his initial target, one of those spikes. The red-colored weapon head clanged against it, about eye level with a furious, wildly dancing dwarf, followed by a strike with a bluish one a bit lower down. The spike bent outward. Aphrogate hit it again in the same place, once, twice, and the spike fell away, leaving enough room for the companions to squeeze through and into the castle bailey. Aphrogate came to a sudden stop, his morning star heads bouncing around him. He planted his hands on his hips and inspected his handiwork, then gave a nod of acceptance.
"For a bit of a kick is why ye got me hired. Anything else ye're wantin' blasting while I got 'em fired?"
Seven stunned expressions, and the look of one bored wizard came back at him, eliciting a roaring, "Bwaha!" Would that he slips with both, and hits himself repeatedly in the face. And Trary muttered to Jarlaxle, "So then when he's gone, my friend and Trary can take his place?" The drow quipped back, "Shut up. He is a powerful ally, and a mighty enemy. Watch him closely, then." "From behind," Entreri agreed. Entreri did just that, staring hard at the dwarf, who stood with hands on hips, gazing through the gap he had hammered in the portcullis. The power of those swings, magic and muscle, were noteworthy, the assassin knew, as was the ease with which Aphrogate handled his weapons. Entreri didn't particularly like the dwarf, and wanted to throttle him with every stupid rhyme. But the assassin respected the dwarf's martial prowess. He suspected that he would soon come to blows with Aphrogate, and he was not looking forward to that appointment. Before the group, beyond the corridor cutting between the two small gatehouses, the castle's lower bailey opened wide. To either side of the gatehouse corridor they could see openings, stairwells leading to the wall top, with perhaps inner tunnels snaking through the wide walls.
"Left, right, or center?" Aphrogate asked. "Best we quickly enter."
"Will you stop that?" Entreri demanded, and he got a typical "Bwahaha" in reply.
"The book is straight back, yes?" Maria Brone asked Arrayan, who was standing at his side. The woman paused for a moment and tried to get her bearings, her eyes fixed upon the central keep, the largest structure in the castle, which loomed beyond the inner bailey wall.
"Yes," she said. "Straight back, I think."
"Do better than that,"
Canthan bade her, but Arrayan had only a weak and apologetic expression in response.
"Then straight ahead," Ellery told the dwarf.
Entreri noticed that Jarlaxle moved as if to say something in protest. The drow stayed silent, though, and noted the look the assassin was offering his way. "Be ready," Jarlaxle quietly warned.
"What do you know?"
Jarlaxle only shrugged, but Entreri had been around the drow long enough to understand that he would not have said anything if he wasn't quite sure that trouble was looming.
In looking at the castle, the dark stones and hard iron, Entreri had the same feeling. They moved through the gates and halted on the muddy courtyard. Aphrodite the lead, Practice and Ellery close behind. Jarlaxle paused as he soon slipped through the portcullis and swayed with a sudden weakness. An overwhelming feeling of power seemed to focus its sentient attention on him. He looked at Arrayan and knew immediately that it was not her. The castle had progressed far beyond her. The drow's eyes went to the ground ahead, and in his mind he looked down, down, past the skeletons buried in the old graveyard, for that is what the place once had been. He visualized tunnels and a great chamber. He knew that something down there was waiting for him. The others took no note of Jarlaxle's delay, for they were more concerned with what lay ahead. A few stone buildings dotted the open bailey, a stable against the left-hand wall immediately inside, a blacksmith shop situated in the same place on the right, and a pair of long, low-ceilinged barracks stretching back from both side walls to the base of the taller wall that blocked the inner bailey. The only freestanding structure was a round, two-story squat tower, set two-thirds of the way across the courtyard before the gates of the inner wall. Maria Brone moved up beside Ellery and motioned to the tower. The commander nodded her agreement and waved for Aphrodite to lead the way. "I would not," Jarlaxle started to say, but his words were buried by Aphrodite's sudden shout. All eyes turned to the dwarf as he leaped back, or tried to, for a skeletal hand had thrust up through the soft summer tundra dirt to hold fast his ankle. Aphrodite twisted, yelped, and went tumbling to the ground. He was back to his feet almost as soon as he landed, though, leaping up and shouting out again, but in rage, not surprise. The skeletal hand clawed higher into the air, a bony arm coming out to the elbow. Aphrodite's morning star smashed it to dust. But the skeleton's other hand prodded through the soil to the side, and as the dwarf moved to smash that one, he cried, "Hunnards!" Perhaps it was an exaggeration born of shock, or perhaps it was an accurate assessment. For all across soft ground of the outer bailey, the skeletal hands of long-dead humanoids clawed up through the hard soil. Aphrodite finished the skeleton's second hand and charged ahead, roaring, "Skinny bones to grind to dust!" And Practice leaped up right beside him, presenting his anvil-shaped holy symbol. The priest swore, "By the wisdom of Moradin, the grace of Dumathoin, and the strength of Clangadin, I damn thee foul beasts to dust!" One skeleton, half out of its hole, vibrated under waves of unseen energy, its bony frame rattling loudly. But the others, all across the way, continued to claw their way free of the turf. Black spots danced before Jarlaxle's eyes, and his head thrummed with a rhythmic chanting, an arcane and evil-sounding cant, calling to the skeletons. The skull-shaped gem in his button seemed to gain weight and substance then, and he felt it vibrating on his chest. Through its power, the drow keenly sensed the awakening around him and understood the depth of the undead parade. From the sheer strength of the call, he expected that the place had served as a burial ground for the Palaszczuk half-orcs or their orc ancestors for centuries. Hundreds of skeletal teeth rattled in the drow's thoughts. Hundreds of long-dead voices awakened once more in a communal chanted song. And there remained that one, deeper, larger force, overwhelming with its strength. He felt a squeeze on his biceps and cried out, then spun and used the magic of his bracer to drop a dagger into his hand. He started a strike, but felt his wrist grabbed suddenly, brutally. Jarlaxle opened his eyes as if awakening from a bad dream, and there stood a confused and none too happy Artemis Entreri, holding him arm and wrist and staring at him dumbfounded. "No, it is all right," the dark elf assured him as he shook his head and pulled away. "What are you seeing?" Entreri asked. "What do you know?" "That we are in trouble," the drow answered, and together the pair turned to face the rising onslaught. "Cleave with your sword, don't stab," the drow informed Entreri. "Good to have you looking out for me," Entreri sarcastically replied, before he leaped forward and slashed across at an approaching skeleton.
Karin's claw cut through the reaching monster's ribs to slam hard against its backbone. Entreri expected the blow to cut the skinny, undead monstrosity in half, but the skeleton staggered a couple of steps to the side and came on again. And again Entreri hit it, even harder. Then again as the stubborn creature relentlessly moved in. The assassin fell back a step, then dived sidelong as a brilliant bolt of lightning flashed before him, blasting through the skeleton. The bony monster staggered several steps with that hit, and a pair of ribs fell away along with one arm. But still it came on, heading toward the disbelieving Jarlaxle and the slender wand the drow held. Entreri waded in and cracked the skeleton's skull with a two-handed downward chop. Finally, the undead creature fell to the ground, its bony frame folding up into a neat pile.
"Not your ordinary animations," Jarlaxle remarked.
"We are in trouble," Entreri agreed.
Pratkus stared at his anvil-shaped silver holy symbol as if it had deceived him. The dwarf's lip quivered, and he whispered the name of his gods one after another, the trembling in his voice begging them for an explanation.
"Blunt weapons!" he heard Maria Brone cry. "Shatter their bones!"
But the dwarf priest stood there, shaking his head in disbelief. A bony hand came out of the ground and grabbed him by the ankle, but Pratkus, still muttering, easily managed to yank his foot away. A second hand clawed forth from the ground, and in the torn turf between them, the top of a skull appeared. Pratkus howled, and he held the screaming note, leaped into the air, and dropped straight down, his metal-shod fist leading in a pile-driving punch atop the skull. He felt the bone crackle beneath him, but the angry dwarf, far from satisfied, put his feet under him again. He leaped up and bashed the skull again, smashing his hand right through it. The reaching fingers on the skeletal hands shivered and bent over, becoming very still.
"Good enough for ye, ye devils!"
the confused and angry dwarf remarked. Then he slugged the skull yet again. Maria Brone didn't draw his long sword, but instead brought forth a small mace. Relying more on speed and skill than on brute force, the ranger whirled, slapping repeatedly at a pair of skeletons coming in at him. None of the blows was heavy in nature, but chip after chip fell away as Maria Brone, seeming almost like a king's drummer, rattled off dozens of strikes. Beside him, Ellery didn't bother changing weapons, as her heavy bladed axe was equally devastating to bone as to flesh. Fragments of rib or arm or leg splintered under her devastating chops. But still the skeletons came on, undeterred and unafraid, and for every one that Ellery or Maria Brone broke apart, two more took its place. Behind them, Olgercon worked his club frantically, and Arrayan fired off a series of minor magic spells, glowing missiles of pure energy mostly. But neither were overly effective, and both half-orcs were obviously tiring quickly again. Olgercon shielded Arrayan with his sizable bulk, and grunted more in pain than battle rage as bony fingers raked at his flesh. Then he howled in terror as one skeleton slipped past him. It had an open path to Arrayan. The large half-orc tried to turn and catch up, but was surprised to learn that he didn't have to, for the animated undead monster did not approach the woman. Olgercon believed he knew why. He closed on the skeleton and smashed it with all his strength anyway, not wanting the others to take note of its aversion to Arrayan. Of all the companions, none was better equipped to deal with such creatures than was Athrogate. His spinning morning stars, though he hadn't placed any of the enchantments upon them, devastated the skeletal ranks, each strike reducing bone to dust or launching a skull from its perch atop a bony spine. The dwarf truly seemed to be enjoying himself as he leaped ahead of the others into the midst of a skeletal swarm. His weapons worked in a devastating blur, and white powder filled the air around them, every explosive hit accompanied by his howling laughter. Canthan stayed close to his diminutive companion the whole time. The wizard enacted only one more spell, summoning a huge, disembodied, semi-translucent hand that floated in mid-air before him. A skeleton rushed in at him, and the five-fingered guardian grasped it, wrapping huge digits around its bony frame. With a grin and a thought, Canthan commanded the hand to squeeze, and the skeleton shattered beneath the power of its grip. The hand, closed into a fist, darted across as a second skeleton approached the wizard. The spell effect slugged the creature hard and sent it flying away.
Press on, Maria Brone ordered. The keep is our goal, our only goal.
But the ranger's words were lost to the wind a moment later, when Ulger Khan faltered and cried out. Maria Brone turned to see the large half-orc slumped to one knee, his half-hearted swings barely fending the clawing skeletons.
"Dwarves to him!"
the ranger cried. Prakas took up the charge, throwing himself at the skeletons crushing in around Ulger Khan, but Aphrogate was too far away and too wildly engaged to begin to extract himself. Similarly, Jarlaxle had lagged behind back by the wall. The drow showed no eagerness to wade out into the mounting throng of undead, despite the fact that his companion, though his weapons were ill-suited for battling skeletons, had moved toward the half-orcs before the ranger had even cried out. Canthan, too, did not go for Ulger Khan and Arrayan, but instead slipped to one side as the ranger and Ellery turned and went for the half-orcs. Canthan retreated to the position held clear by Jarlaxle. With a thought, the wizard sent his enchanted hand back out behind him, gigantic fingers flicking aside skeletons. It reached Aphrogate, who looked at it with some curiosity. Then it grabbed the dwarf and lifted him from his feet. The hand sped him in fast pursuit of its wizard master. Maria Brone, Ellery, and Prakas formed a defensive triangle around Ulger Khan, beating back the skeleton's assault. And Treri, meanwhile, grabbed Arrayan by the arm and started to pull her away, slashing aside any undead interference. "Come along," he ordered the woman, but he felt her lagging behind, and when he glanced at her, he understood why. Arrayan collapsed to the ground. And Treri sheathed his weapons, slipped his arm around her shoulders, then slid his other arm under her knees and hoisted her. Slipping in and out of consciousness, Arrayan still managed to put her arms around Entreri's neck to help secure the hold. The assassin ran off, zigzagging past the skeletons. Behind Entreri, when a break finally presented itself, Maria Brone grabbed Ulger Khan and ushered him to his feet. Still, when the ranger let him go, the half-orc nearly fell over again.
"I do so enjoy babysitting," Canthan muttered, as Entreri carried the nearly unconscious Arrayan beside him.
Entreri scowled, and for a moment both Jarlaxle and Canthan thought he might lash out at the insulting wizard.
"Is she wounded?" the drow asked. Entreri shrugged as he considered the shaky woman, for he saw no obvious signs of injury.
"Yes. Pray tell us why our friend Arrayan needs to be carried around when there is not a drop of her blood spilled on the field,"
Canthan put in. Again, Entreri scowled at him.
"Tend to your friend, wizard," he said,
a clear warning, as the disembodied hand floated in and deposited a very angry Aphrogate on the ground before them.
"Join up and battle to the keep," Maria Brone called to the group.
"Too many," Jarlaxle shouted back.
"We cannot fight them on the open field. Our only hope is through the wall tunnels."
Maria Brone didn't immediately answer, but one look across the field showed him and the three with him that the drow's observations were on target. For dozens of skeletons were up and approaching, and more clawing skeletal hands were tearing through practically every inch of turf across the outer bailey.
"Clear a path for them," Canthan ordered Aphrogate.
The dwarf gave a great snort and set his morning stars to spinning again. Canthan's huge magical hand worked beside him, and soon the pair had cleared the way for Maria Brone and the other three to rejoin those at the wall. Jarlaxle disappeared into the left-hand gatehouse, then came back out a few moments later and motioned for them all to follow. Shielded by Canthan's magical hand, holding back the undead horde, all nine slipped into the gatehouse and into the tunnel beyond. A heavy door was set at the end of that tunnel, which Maria Brone closed and secured not a moment too soon, for before the ranger had even turned around to regard the other eight, the clawing of skeletal fingers sounded on the portal.
"An auspicious beginning, I would say," said Canthan.
"The castle protects itself," Jarlaxle agreed.
"It protects many things, so it would seem," Canthan replied,
and he managed a sly glance Arrayan's way.
"We cannot continue like this," Maria Brone scolded. "We are fighting in pockets, protective of our immediate companions and not of the group as a whole. Might be that we didn't think some'd be needin' so much damn protecting,"
Aphrogate muttered, his steely-eyed gaze locked on the two half-orcs.
"It is what it is, good dwarf," said the ranger. "This group must find harmony and unity if we are to reach the keep and find our answers.
We are here together, nine as one.
Bah!
Therein lies our only hope, said Maria Brone. To the apparent surprise of Atherogate, Canth